Now, we come to chapter 8 in Daniel, and here is Daniel's vision of the ram and he-goat and another little horn. And this is a very important chapter, and yet it's already been fulfilled. All of this, when it was given, it was prophetic, and it was fulfilled. And by the way, this is the chapter that a great many of the radical critics, they use this chapter as the basis for giving a late date of Daniel. And you know the argument rests on this. Well, we know that to prophesy concerning the future is supernatural. We do not believe in the supernatural. Therefore, this could not be given as prophecy. It was written afterward as history. And you know, that probably is about the weakest argument that there is. It's not our purpose in this study to go in introductory matters, but I want to say to you, you can't maintain the late date of Daniel. Daniel was written by Daniel. I always think of what Mark Twain said about Shakespeare. You know, there's a debate, by the way, whether Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare or not. Some thought Bacon wrote it. And a professor of mine, he wrote a paper once, Bringing Home the Bacon. And he believed that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare. Well, Mark Twain answered that. He said Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare. It was written by another man by the same name. Well, you can say about the book of Daniel, then, to answer the critics. Daniel of 600 and something B.C. did not write Daniel, but it was written by another man by the same name at the same date. Now, that brings us here to chapter 8. And you have in the first 14 verses the vision of the ram and the he-goat. And then the action is given to us beginning with verse 8, actually through 14. And then beginning with verse 15, we have the meaning of the vision, goes through verse 27. Now let's just look at this prophecy here for just a moment that is before us. Now this prophecy of the ram with two unmatched horns and the he-goat with one horn, it places a microscope down on the conflict that existed between the second and third world empires in the struggle of East and West. That was important, of the Orient and the Occident, Asia and Europe. It was the empire of the Medo-Persian and then the empire of the Greco-Macedonian. Now, we are going to see a little horn here again. He's already been fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes, and we're going to see that when we get to it. And we find all of this is already fulfilled today. Now, there's something else we ought to say about this section, and that is that beginning at verse 4 of chapter 2 through this last chapter, chapter 7, it was written in Aramaic. That was the original language, or Syriac. And now we return back to Hebrew here. But you and I'll stick with the English translation, of course. So that makes it intensely interesting. What we have seen was given in the world language of these four great empires. Now, we're going to have some specifics given to us in this section here. And so we'll see the division of the goat empire of Alexander into four kingdoms. And that seriously involved Israel. And then we'll see the downfall of the Medo-Persian empire and how it fell. This is something that is very important because it concerned the nation Israel. Now, let's get right into it. We have what is called the vision of the ram and he-goat. Verse 1. We have now the time and place of this vision. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. Now this is the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, and it places this vision as the other toward the end of the Babylonian Empire, for Belshazzar was the last king. Now, chapter 7 that we just looked at, that was given in the first year of his reign. Now, verse 2, "And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw that I was at Shushan the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Uli." In the vision, Daniel finds himself at Shushan, which is Susa, the capital of Media Persia, which actually was the second world empire. And he was in the palace. More accurately, he was near the fortress. And Uli is the Kirkhar River, which flowed by Susa. Now, the reason for the setting of the vision being at Susa rather than Babylon is that this vision concerns the second and third world empires. The events foretold in this vision were all fulfilled within 200 years. Now, such fulfillment is so remarkable that the liberal critic, as we've indicated before, he insists upon a late dating of Daniel. That is, he maintains that Daniel was written after these events had transpired, and so is merely a historical record. In an attempt to get rid of the miraculous, which is, of course, embarrassing to the liberal system of interpretation. Now, will you notice here in verses 3 and 4, we have the vision now. "Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last." Now, let me pause there at the end of verse 3 to identify the ram here. The ram had two horns. Now, that's Media Persia. It says that the horn that came up last was higher than the other. In other words, the Median came up first. It was Gebras, the Median general, that destroyed Babylon. And then later, the Persian monarchs, they gained the ascendancy over the Median, and they took the kingdom, this great empire, to its heights. So that the ram now, here with two horns, one horn that's more prominent than the other, it's the Media-Persian empire with the Persian being in the ascendancy. Now, verse 4, "I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great." Now, do you notice the directions in which he moved? "I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward." Now, why doesn't it say that he's pushing eastward? Well, that's where he was, in the east. The Persian Empire was right on the door of civilization of that day. You'd open the door, you'd step into the Orient, of course, India and China. And at that time, this was where the action was. And so he's moving in every direction. He is projecting this empire out in all different directions. Now, we find here that this is the Persian Empire. And that's the bear in the 7th chapter. Now, it's a ram that's put before us because it serves the purpose. Now, he pushes north and west and south. And the Persians were all motivated by the spirit of conquest. I think that was true of all of them. Now, will you notice this? We have now the other side of the vision, the rough goat with one dominant horn, and he destroys the ram. Verse 5, "And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west," that is, out of Europe now, "on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes." Now, this is a one-horned goat, a unicorn. Now, Daniel was marveling at the power and the ability of the ram. But yonder in the west, there came a goat, and with great movement, and he had a dominant horn. Now, that goat represents Greece. And if you doubt that, you just turn over with me to verse 21. We read this, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that's between his eyes is the first king, and that was Alexander the Great. Now, we are able to identify this pretty easy here. What happens is Persia attempted to move into the west, and under Xerxes, that effort was made. But out of the west, there comes this goat, and he's moving so fast, he doesn't even touch the ground. That speaks of the four wings, you remember, that was on the panther, the leopard. And it speaks of Alexander the Great. Now, let's keep moving. Verse 6 and 7. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him. And, of course, that means he was moved with anger and great hatred against him. And, actually, he ran into him in order to destroy him. And I saw him come close unto the ram, moved with choler, with hatred, with anger against him. And he smote the ram, broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Now, Xerxes was really the last great ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire, and he made a foray against Europe, against Greece. And he was moving, my gracious, 300,000 men with their families. And the Greek soldiers were smart. They didn't go out to meet him. They waited until he got to Thermopylae. Well, that was a narrow pass, and you couldn't put a big army in there. But one Greek soldier was equal to at least 10 of the Medo-Persian, because actually they were not a trained, disciplined army as the Greeks had. So the Greeks were able to get the victory at Thermopylae. They just had to change shifts there and take care of that tremendous army as they attempted to advance a few at a time through the pass. And then at Salamis, the fleet of Xerxes was destroyed by a storm, 300 vessels. Xerxes, as we've seen before in the book of Esther, he actually had a few bats in his belfry, too. That's been characteristic of the rulers of the world. When the word was brought to him that his fleet had been destroyed by a storm, he went down and took off his belt and he beat the waves because they had destroyed his fleet. Now, that, I would say, is not the mark of an outstanding, intelligent man by any means. Well, anyway, that was the last effort that the East made to move toward the West. They never were able after that to make any great dent. Now, it's true that the great hordes of Muhammad, the Muslim forces, came up through Spain, the Moors, but Charles Martel stopped them at the Battle of Tours, and it's true that they attempted the Turks coming up through the east, through the Balkans. They made a stab at it, but it failed. But actually, this was the last great effort of a great world empire. And now there rises in the West this tremendous general, a young man. He was just 33 years of age when he died. He was a military genius, probably the greatest. And he was moving his army with great speed. He could move a power-striking force probably quicker than any other man, any other general's been able to do. Now, will you notice what happens here, and I'm reading verse 8. We are told, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, And when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, what was it that broke this horn? There was no power that could break it. We're told that when he came to power, the whole world was under the heel of Alexander the Great. And tradition says that he sat down and wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. He had conquered the then known world. Well, he died one night because he was seized by a fever after a night-long drinking bout, and he died in Babylon in the year 323 B.C., and he was 33 years when he was strong. The great horn was broken. Now, we have had before us three great world empires, Babylon, the Media-Persian, and the Greek Empire. All three went down in a drunken orgy, by the way. Drink was the determining factor. Now, I said I would be coming back to this. I asked some time ago for statistics on the use of alcohol in our nation, and I found out that the thing to do when I need somebody to do research, I'm going to ask you folk to do it. I've gotten some wonderful information. Now, let me say that our nation today, I do not think, will be destroyed by marijuana or heroin, but alcohol will destroy us. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not for legalizing marijuana, and I think the drug traffic is a grave danger. But while we're so busy on that front, we've forgotten that alcohol destroys nations, and it's destroyed nations in the past. Now, here are some statistics that are alarming. They ought to be. Almost half of the 55,000 deaths on the U.S. highways and streets were the result of alcohol drinking. In other words, 27,000 highway deaths related to alcohol consumption. That means that in 2 years, more people are killed by alcohol than in Vietnam. And we had a lot of protest movements. People carried banners. When did you see your last banner with somebody carrying a whiskey bottle on it and saying, this is the real danger to America today? But they don't do that, do they? Because there are too many people drinking liquor. And it's estimated that 9 million American workers, now these are people who hold jobs, are alcoholics. And I'm told that 450,000 of them are right here in Los Angeles County. It's the reason that practically every morning on the freeway, there are accidents and many deaths. So that today, this is alarming. $15 billion is spent annually for liquor. And we are seeing that this tremendous number, and that doesn't include a great many women and a great many people that are not working who are alcoholics. May I say to you, this great empire of Alexander the Great went down because he was an alcoholic. He conquered the world, but he couldn't conquer Alexander the Great. And the grave danger today in Washington is not the Democrats or the Republicans, yet I'm of the opinion that both of them present a problem today. But the big problem is the cocktail parties over which decisions of our government are made. That's alarming, friends. Why do we think that we're something special? There are a certain group of people that think the United States happens to be God's little pet. And there are others today that assume that we are so superior intellectually, and evolution has produced us, and we just happen to be at the top of the totem pole, and there's not a chance of us going down. My friend, it's time somebody's blowing the whistle and saying that we're on the way out. And if I read prophecy aright, we're on the way out. Now, will you notice that when Alexander the Great went out, what happened? Well, his empire was divided among four men. four generals, Cassander, who had married Alexander's sister, he took Europe, that is Macedonian Greece. Lysimachus, he took Asia Minor, which is the greater part of modern Turkey. And Seleucus, he took Asia and all the eastern part of Alexander's empire but Egypt. And then Ptolemy, he took Egypt and North Africa. Now, verse 9, and out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. What's the pleasant land? Israel. Now, this was the Seleucidae monarchy, or dynasty, that took Syria. He attempted to take the land of Israel. And the one that's mentioned here, this little horn, he was Antiochus the Fourth, or Epiphanes. He was son of Antiochus the Great. And sometimes he's called Epimenes, the madman. Here we go again with these demented rulers. And he came to the throne in 170 B.C., and he made his attack upon Jerusalem, and it was against him that the book of Maccabees, that the Maccabees were raised up. And anti-Semitism was at the core and heart of this man. And he placed an image of Jupiter in the holy place, and that was the first abomination of desolation, because he took swine and boiled a pig and took the broth and put it on all the holy vessels. Now we're told in verse 10, it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon him. This statement is admittedly difficult of interpretation. I think the natural interpretation is that Antiochus challenged God, and he was permitted to capture Jerusalem and the temple. And for that reason, there was a warfare that was a spiritual warfare, where I think demonic and heavenly power was involved. There's a great deal we don't know yet, friends. Verse 11, yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now, he was a devotee of Jupiter, and he chose for himself the title Theos Epiphanes, that is, God manifest. Now, verse 12, and a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by a reason of transgression. That is, it was by the permissive will of God that this little horn practiced and prospered during this period. Now we come down here to verse 13, where it says, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake. And this is a holy one, which actually refers to one of God's created intelligences other than man, what we would call a supernatural creature. I often wonder what angels call us, by the way. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spoke, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? Now, this is the little horn that came up, brought in an abomination of desolation. And it has to do with the temple and the putting up of an idol there. Verse 14, and he said unto me, under 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now, this refers to Antiochus Epiphanes at the time of the Maccabees that were raised up and the awful period that Israel went through. It's in what we would call the Inner Testament period. That is between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The time here was limited to 2,300 days. Now, there's been always a great deal of disagreement as to the interpretation of these 2,300 days. As many of you already know, Seventh-day Adventism was largely based on this passage of Scripture. It grew out of the great Second Advent Awakening way back over 100 years ago, in which this verse was given the day-year interpretation, and the date for Christ's coming was set for the year 1843. You see, 2,300 years from this date when this happened, why, it was assumed it would be 1843. And at that time, William Miller and his followers, among whom was Ms. Ellen G. White, they understood the sanctuary to be the earth which should be cleansed at his coming. Now, Miller was a very sincere but a badly mistaken Baptist preacher, and the day-year interpretation was a fragile and insecure foundation for any theory of prophecy. History has demonstrated, of course, that it was a false assumption. If the 2,300 days are taken as being literal 24-hour days, the period would be between 6 and 7 years, which approximates the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. He was of the line of Seleucus that controlled Syria, and he was an inveterate hater of Israel. And in 170 B.C., he began to perpetuate and to perpetrate his atrocities. And the priest Judas Maccabeus, called the Hammer, he drove out the Syrian army in 165 B.C., at which time the temple was cleansed and rededicated after its pollution, because this man had polluted it. He put up an image of Jupiter and had taken sow's broth and spread it over all the holy vessels. And the cleansing, of course, is celebrated in the Feast of Lights. You remember in John 10:22, we're told, and it was at Jerusalem, the Feast of the Dedication, or the rededication, or lights, and it was winter. That was the celebration. That is one of the holy days that they remember and remembered in Christ's day and still remember, that actually is not mentioned in the Old Testament at all, because it took place between the Old and New Testament period. Now, the meaning of the vision of the ram and goat is important for us. And it was Gabriel who was commissioned now to give Daniel a meaning. I'm reading now verses 15 and 16. And it came to pass, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. And Daniel, you see, was puzzled by the vision, and he desired to learn the meaning of it. And there appeared to him now a heavenly angel, Gabriel. And by the way, this is the first time Gabriel's introduced to us in the Bible. Now, here is to be the interpretation, verse 17. The ram is Media Persia. We weren't guessing at that while ago. Will you listen? So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now you see Gabriel in the explanation that follows makes it clear that Antiochus is but a picture in miniature of the coming Antichrist. And you'll notice it's for the time of the end, not the end of time. Nowhere in the Bible are we told about the end of time. Here it's the time of the end. And it locates the complete fulfillment in the Antichrist, in that period that we have labeled, we didn't label it, the Lord Jesus did, the Great Tribulation period. And he is Antichrist, the man of sin, and the little horn of chapter 7. Now, this prophecy goes beyond the immediate future, and it's projected into the distant future. You see, it covered that immediate period, but it was an adumbration. It's a little picture of that which is future, and that's important to see, by the way, very important. Antiochus is merely a type of the other little horn who's going to come at the end of the times of the Gentiles. This is, I think, made abundantly clear by the use of these eschatological terms. Now, verse 18. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. You notice the physical effect of this vision upon Daniel. Now, verse 19. And he said, Behold, I'll make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. For at the time appointed, the end shall be. You see, now Gabriel moves from the local fulfillment in Antiochus to the end of the times of the Gentiles. Now the ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. Now you see they're identified for us. There's no speculation. You're a guesswork. The ram is definitely identified for us. The kings of Media and Persia. Now we turn to the goat here, verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So the rough goat is likewise labeled the king of Greece, and the great horn, the first king, is Alexander the Great. Now, verse 22. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. In other words, none of these kingdoms would have power to take over all of them, and actually no one kingdom would be as powerful as all of them under Alexander the Great. Now, I've dropped down to verse 23, and the little horn is identified for us here. He's Antiochus Epiphanes, of the line of the Seleucidae that took Syria. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Now, it's a direct reference to Antiochus Epiphanes. The only adequate explanation of this verse and of the facts of history is that this man was demon-possessed. In this also, he's a picture of the coming Antichrist, by the way. Now, we are told there shall arise false Christs, false prophets shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if were possible, they'll deceive the very elect. That's what the Lord Jesus said in Matthew 24:24. Now, I read verse 24 here in the 8th of Daniel. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper, and practice, and destroy the mighty and the holy people. Now the holy people here refer to Israel. And the slaughter of these people by Antiochus Epiphanes seems almost unbelievable. He was as bad as Hitler ever was. And he's merely an adumbration of the one who's coming, not Hitler, but Hitler is a picture of the one that's coming. And he's outlined for us in Revelation 13:7. It was given unto him to make war with the saints, to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. Now verse 25, and through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Now, Antiochus was but a faint type of this king that's coming, and he shall do four things which Antiochus did in pygmy style. First, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. When we're told when Antichrist comes that no man will buy or sell save the one that had the mark of the beast. And then the other thing is he will control the economy with a vengeance. And then the next, he shall magnify himself in his heart. There's given unto him, we're told in Revelation 13:5, a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. In other words, humility is not a characteristic of the Antichrist. He's like Satan. Now, the third thing is, by peace he shall destroy many. He comes in as a lamb, but he goes out as a lion. You see, the rider on the white horse of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, right after him comes the red horse of war. He brings in a false peace. And then the fourth and last, he shall also stand up against the prince of princes. You see, he is to oppose and fight against Christ. One of the marks of Antichrist and of that first beast in Revelation 13, he's against Christ. That's important to note. Now, verse 26, and the vision of the evening and the morning, which is told, is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision? It shall be for many days. Now, Daniel was told that the vision would be for the distant future, for many days to come. That is, what was happening there in history would be out yonder in the future. History would be a picture of the future. Verse 27, and I, Daniel, fainted. I was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business. And I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. You see, the physical and the psychological effect of this vision upon Daniel was devastating. God is beginning, you see, at this point, to mesh in the times of the Gentiles into the history of the nation Israel. That was the thing that puzzled Daniel at the first, puzzles a great many people today. How can God mesh in his program with Israel and his program with the Gentiles in the world, and today, to further complicate it, his program with the church? Well, it's quite simple, of course. God's calling out a people today to his name. That's the church. And when that is concluded and the church is removed, then he again turns to his purpose in Israel and the Gentile nations. Today's calling out a people, which is altogether different.